Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today, should college students be legally allowed to carry guns on campus? Several states are debating legislation. But first, news from Wall Street that investors and economists are bracing themselves for more bad news after Bear Stearns, one of the largest and most venerable investment houses, was bought by J.P. Morgan Chase yesterday for 10% of its worth just last Friday. Bear Stearns had invested heavily in risky mortgages, and it's not yet known how fast its losses might take down at-risk banks or if regulators can stop the bleeding. Days after racing to provide Bear Stearns with cash last week, the Federal Reserve took further extraordinary measures yesterday, becoming the lender of last resort for struggling banks, cutting rate loans for them and hinting at further rate cuts tomorrow. Well, Nariman Berevesh is chief economist with the analysis firm Global Insight. Nariman, world stocks plunged overnight and on Wall Street stocks fell sharply at the opening bell, but they've rebounded somewhat. So what is the feeling on Wall Street today?
I think it's fair to say that the market's in quite a bit of turmoil, and they can't quite decide whether or not what the Fed did over the weekend, which is to facilitate this purchase of Bear Stearns by J.P. Morgan and also opening up their discount window, whether or not that's good news in the sense that, you know, the cavalry's coming to save the day, so to speak, or if it's bad news in the sense that the Fed's panicked. So I think it's up, down, up, down. There's a lot of that kind of movement going on in the market these days.
And people are confused as well. Just remind us, what did Bear Stearns do? Was it like a bank that I could go and open a checking account with?
No, you think of it as a brokerage house. I mean, they were out there selling and holding these investment vehicles, these securitized mortgages, as they were called, these package mortgages. And so they're not a bank in the sense that you and I could go to the local Bear Stearns office and deposit money and get a loan. They're more, think of it as a full-scale, large-scale brokerage house.
Or a bank to other big companies. At the New York Times, Floyd Norris writes, other big losers now might be Lehman Brothers, Citibank, Goldman Sachs. I know, you know, some people don't like to speculate, but just tell us, do you think another big house will go?
I think there certainly is a very high risk that one or more large investment banks and possibly commercial banks, although I think there's a slightly less risk of the commercial banks going under than the investment banks, and that's simply because the investment banks, these brokerage houses, had much bigger exposures to the subprime problem.
Well, so what happens now? I mean, New York Times columnist Paul Krugman is saying that, you know, okay, he advocates bailing out the system, but not the people who got us into this mess. Is that possible to do one without the other?
It's a little tricky, although I have to say, I mean, that clearly there are a lot of people who are at the heart of this, who have been punished and punished pretty severely, including the people at Bear Stearns. So I think to somehow or other hold out for more punishment against these people and risk a bigger financial crisis would be a serious mistake.
What's the debate now on Wall Street? If there's a question about what the Federal Reserve has already done, is there a debate as to whether or not it should do more?
I think the debate is this going to be enough, and is some kind of even more radical action required? And typically when people talk about that, they talk about a true government bailout in the way that the savings and loan banks were bailed out in the late 80s, early 1990s.
Well, and you know, you say it's been bad certainly for Bear Stearns or anybody who had all their investments in Bear Stearns, but what about the ordinary, you know, person with the checking account?
Well, I think they're definitely at risk, and if something is not done to somehow or other alleviate this crisis, this panic, if you will, in the markets, then I think we're all going to be hurt. And by that, I mean sort of the entire economy, you know, the average household will be hurt in any number of ways, including, you know, job losses, the unemployment rate going up. So that's what the Fed is trying to avoid at all costs.
Right, and getting some cash into a fluid forward motion so that it's available for people. Nariman Berevesh, chief economist with the analysis firm Global Insight. Nariman, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Well, for the first time ever, the Supreme Court could decide this week which gun rights are protected by the Second Amendment. The court will hear arguments tomorrow in a challenge to Washington, D.C.'s ban on handguns. The decision will affect gun laws across the country, but could also, once and for all, decide if the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms applies to individuals or just to militias. We're going to keep an eye on this important story for you. But meanwhile, several states are considering laws to allow students to carry weapons on campus. That debate began after the tragedies at Virginia Tech and Northern Illinois universities in the last year when student gunmen opened fire and then took their own lives. In a moment, the case against guns on college campuses. But first, Brent Tenney is a 25-year-old senior at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. He carries a concealed weapon on campus because Utah is the only state where that is already allowed. Brent, you start us off. What kind of gun do you carry?
It's a Glock 19. It's similar to the weapons the police would use, in fact.
And you have? Does it have to be concealed on campus?
Yeah, I keep it concealed at all times.
Now, why do you even carry it?
For self-defense, because I think that police with better ammunition or no ammunition at all, they're not always there to defend you. I mean, I think past experiences at other universities have proven that they can't be there to respond in a timely manner always.
Have you had a personal experience?
I've had a couple situations where, you know, I felt I was in danger and didn't like the feeling of being utterly helpless and at the mercy of someone who I didn't know and who was obviously hostile to me.
Do you find yourself when you're in class, maybe daydreaming, what would I do? I mean, does it become something that you think about?
I've had thoughts before, like, you know, how would I react to that after the Virginia Tech thing? I wondered if I would be, you know, able to defend myself to shoot the bad guy or, if, you know, what it would be like.
And what do you think?
I think it would even the odds. I can't say for certain that I would definitely get him. I don't think I'm Rambo. I have no delusions. I understand that I'm not a police officer. It's not my job to go hunt someone down or search the campus for them. But I think I would stand a better chance with a firearm than without in a situation where there was a school shooting.
What do your friends say?
Some of my friends think it's great that, you know, I'll be there to help them if there's ever a school shooting. Some of my friends think it's terrible that I would even own a gun, let alone carry it with me. And others have asked me if I think I could actually shoot someone.
Is that a question that you feel somebody has to ask themselves before they do this?
I think it's probably reasonable. I think that if you had a firearm and drew it to use in a self-defense situation but didn't have the will, guts, desire to follow through, that it could make the situation infinitely worse.
Well, you know the criticism, though. If, let's say, you're in a slightly dangerous situation, maybe somebody's just eyeing you warily, some would say you might be more likely to use the gun inappropriately to kill someone when, in fact, they weren't presenting as much of a danger as you might have thought. Are you worried about that, about using your gun and making a mistake?
In order to get a concealed carry permit, you have to go through classes and training. They teach you when it's appropriate and when it's not. Yes, there's that hypothetical, theoretical possibility. The record hasn't borne out those concerns, that they haven't been realized in fact.
Well, take us through what you had to do to get a gun. You mentioned taking gun classes. Wasn't it just a 3 to 5 hour class?
Yeah, there's a class you have to take that's mandated by the state that talks about basic firearm operations, maintenance, safety, and then they go ahead and talk about, you know, when it's okay to use lethal force, when you would be justified under the law, discuss when and where you can carry and when and where you can't carry. You have to pass a criminal background check. You have to be fingerprinted. Your fingerprints are sent off to the FBI.
Well, let's talk about some of the questions you might have about carrying a gun on campus. Campus equals drinking, equals, you know, partying. The FBI reports that nearly 1.7 million guns have been stolen in the past 10 years. Somebody could mug you and take your gun. Only 40% of those were recovered. The missing guns could end up committing crimes. You're putting another gun out into that mix on a college campus. What do you think?
I don't think it's very likely that my gun gets stolen on campus. I've heard those concerns raised. I keep mine secured and safe. I would encourage other gun owners to secure their weapons as well.
How does it make you feel to carry a gun?
Safer. It certainly doesn't make me bulletproof, and I'm well aware of that, or knife-proof. In most cases of self-defense with a firearm, simply showing the weapon is enough to deter your attacker. You don't have to fire shots, and no one has to die.
Brent Tenney, 25-year-old senior at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City. He carries a gun on campus. Brent, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Well, as we said, what prompted this debate over guns on campus was that mass shooting at Virginia Tech University last year, where 23-year-old Sungwi Cho shot and killed 32 people before killing himself. A bill to allow guns on campus at public universities in Virginia didn't make it out of committee this year, but the debate has been intense on the Virginia Tech campus, and the student-run newspaper, the Collegiate Times, ran an editorial against guns on campus. Joe Kendall is one of the paper's managing editors. He joins us now. Joe, how did you come to this position? Was there a lot of debate on the staff?
Actually, there wasn't. We were unanimous as a board on this issue.
Well, we understand from the editorial that that Tech students were lobbying to get some state legislation. So obviously some of the student body wanted guns. So how did your board argue against it?
We feel that this is an environment where we're all supposed to feel safe, we're all supposed to feel comfortable. And we feel that guns simply aren't conducive to that sort of environment.
You say that people might be intimidated just knowing that a gun is in somebody's knapsack.
Right.
What other concerns do you have?
You worry about everything from guns being used to settle arguments instead of going through the proper channels. You worry about accidental discharges. You worry about drunken arguments. They add an extra element of danger.
Can you understand, though, you can understand probably better than anybody because you were at Virginia Tech the day of the shooting. That feeling of being trapped in a classroom, being trapped in a study hall, and that feeling of, wanting to protect yourself. Can you understand that?
Absolutely. You can relate to that feeling. But we don't feel that incidents like that are common enough to justify having guns on campus all the time. What you're looking at with Virginia Tech and Northern Illinois are very isolated incidents. They happen once every 20 years. It just so happened that two happened this year. Mm-hmm. They're not common enough to justify damages that might be caused by having guns on campus every single day.
Do you have friends who were either in that room or had someone, lost someone who was in that room?
I did not personally know any of the victims, but no one on this campus was more than 2 degrees of separation from anyone that was killed. I don't know a single person on this campus who didn't either know someone personally or didn't know someone who knew someone personally.
Right. So this national debate is going on now as you guys are, really, this is so raw for you. How does that hit you that, Virginia Tech has become sort of just the bumper sticker for this debate about guns on campus?
No one at Virginia Tech wants to have the school branded as that school where 33 people died. People want the school to be recognized for an excellent engineering program, for, sports, where we have a great football team and a great basketball team. We don't want to be known as, the school where the massacre occurred. At the same time, we know that we can't escape it. So it's something that we do have to live with.
It sounds, at least when it comes to the editorial board of the newspaper, you also don't want to be the reason for guns to appear legally on campuses.
Absolutely not. It's not really right to be using what happened at Virginia Tech as political capital to get guns on campus. It doesn't seem that, you don't know what the wishes of those 32 people were, so it seems a little odd to be using their lives as political capital to push for guns on campus.
Joe Kendall, managing editor at Virginia Tech's student-run newspaper, The Collegiate Times. Joe, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And as we've said, states are debating legislation allowing guns on campus. On Friday, the Oklahoma House approved a bill that would allow guns on college campuses. It has to be approved by the Senate to pass. And Arizona is also considering legislation. Well, when we come back, we're going to hear from a police commander at Arizona State University who opposes guns for students but wants more and higher powered weapons for campus cops. Later today, who's the Big East Basketball Player of the Year? We'll tell you her name back in 1 minute, here and now. We're talking about whether guns should be allowed on college campuses. 15 states, including Alabama, Michigan, Kentucky, and Arizona, proposed laws this year to allow college students to legally carry guns on campus. Well, James Hardina is police commander at Arizona State University. He opposes guns on campus for students. And Jim, the argument is that by allowing students to carry guns, they'll be able to defend themselves in the event of an attack. So what's your thinking on that?
We just don't think it's wise to propose legislation for one isolated incident that's really unlikely to happen. We're looking at the big picture. What about the rest of the time? We have a lot of students on campus, so if you allow guns on campus, you're not only going to have weapons on campus in the unlikely event of a mass shooting situation, but the rest of the year and your domestic violence issues at tailgating at football games, inside the football stadium, in our residential halls, when you have alcohol and disputes and those kinds of things. And we just believe that in the long run, you're more likely to have shootings on campus than not.
Well, now, that's a tough argument to make to, let's say, the parent of a child who was killed on a campus.
There's nothing you're going to tell a parent whose child was killed that, you know, there's no argument you can give. But one of the thoughts is, well, if you have these armed people on campus, when a shooter comes on campus to do a mass shooting, you have all these people that can intervene on behalf of everyone else. Well, the assumption is you have trained people that know how to use the weapon or trained in the laws and those types of things. In Arizona, to get the permit to get a concealed weapons permit, you're not required to have any training. You just do a cursory background check to basically make sure you're not a convicted felon, and then you get a concealed weapons permit. So if you had a Virginia Tech situation, for example, and someone came in there and just started randomly shooting people, and then 15 students popped up with their own guns and started shooting the bad guy. Then a few minutes later, the police arrive. You're going to have chaos. How are the police going to sort out who's the good guy, who's the bad guy? We just think having more guns on campus increases the likelihood of gun violence than having less guns on campus.
Well, and backers of more guns on campus always cite the example of a teenager in 1997 in Mississippi who shot two students to death at Pearl High School, but an assistant principal chased him down and held him at bay with a .45 caliber pistol that he always kept in his truck. There's always that one example that people turn to of when
a shooting was
stopped.
And what people cite is the exception to the rule. The exception is a shooting on campus. The biggest safety issue to any college student in the country is alcohol abuse. More students die in alcohol-related accidents than get shot in mass shootings.
And that's a deadly mix, alcohol and guns.
Exactly. It's a big responsibility to have a gun. You know, as a police officer, you have a gun in your house, and if you take it with you out in the public, you constantly have to be mindful, I have a gun, it's in my backpack, it's on my hip, wherever it is, and you have to worry about other people getting it, other people have access to it. So, like, if you had a dorm room, student had a gun in his sock drawer, for example, all his roommates have access to it. Everyone who knows he has a gun theoretically now has access to that firearm.
Well, some schools are thinking of requiring students to lock up their guns in the room in a safe. Are thinking of in Alabama requiring that students be in ROTC and take extensive gun training if they're going to carry a gun. Would there be any safeguards that would satisfy you to allow kids on campus with guns?
If it's inevitable that you're going to have guns on campus, there's got to be some kind of mandate where you constantly have training and background checks and that type of thing. But it's unlikely that you're going to be able to mandate the type of training and then refresher training that's going to be necessary for the average citizen that's going to be carrying a gun.
What about cultural pressures? In Arizona, people only need a license for concealed weapons. They can actually carry a gun openly without a license. So people are already walking around your state with their guns in full view. And then you put the kids in the middle of a campus, you know, within that culture, and they are not. They're not allowed.
Arizona is a free carry state, so as long as you're not a prohibited possessor, which is basically you're convicted of a felony, as long as it's not concealed, you can carry it in public. However, there's a caveat in the law that allows organizations to prohibit guns. For example, the university has said we don't allow guns on campus. But with this new legislation, that would supersede the university's policy, so then guns would be allowed on campus.
And so the university wouldn't even have a say.
Exactly.
We understand that state universities in Arizona are beefing up firearms, equipping officers with military-style assault rifles. To some, that would seem sort of at odds to your notion of, you know, not wanting more guns in the hands of kids on campus. But is it to help you feel as if you have more control if there is a shooting on campus?
Well, the rifles we're going to carry are, although they look like military rifles, they're not. They're not automatic. They're semi-automatic. The reason is if someone wants to come on a college campus or an elementary school or a church or a supermarket or a shopping mall with the intent of shooting as many people as they can shoot until someone shoots them, there's really nothing you're going to do to prevent it. However, having rifles in the hands of police officers on campus is going to benefit safety in the university because the rifles have a longer range than handguns. So if there was a situation where you had a sniper, it's just one more tool that we can use based on the situation at hand.
One last question for you. We mentioned concealed weapons. And we're learning that concealed weapons have an interesting history in the U.S., that when guns were viewed more benignly in the Wild West, a holstered gun was considered polite, a visible holstered gun. You know, only cowards hid their guns. But now, you know, guns have, you know, they've had many negative associations in some parts of the country. So where do you fall on the concealed versus unconcealed? In other words, if that becomes a question as to how guns might be allowed on campus, it's a tricky question because we wondered which one would be the safest as far as you're concerned.
Safest would be have it exposed. As a police officer, I know if I see someone with a gun, then I know there's a threat, and I know the person is not trying to hide the gun from me. The problem with everyone knowing it's there is it can be taken from you, you can be disarmed, and that kind of thing. But with this new legislation, then you would legally be able to carry guns on campus, but it would not necessarily need to be concealed. So you could legally openly carry like in a holster on your hip, like a cowboy on campus.
James Hardina, police commander at Arizona State University. Thanks so much.
No problem.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, why are guns legal in some places, illegal in others? For that matter, why is it illegal to eat horses in California, but perfectly legal to make horse meat into pet food? We'll look at what financial analysts call the repugnance factor. And still ahead today, a stranger in his homeland will speak with an illegal immigrant deported back to Ireland. That's after the news, Here and Now. There's been quite a debate over immigration here in the U.S., and Paul Ladd and his wife Jenny followed it closely, fighting for reform last year. Paul and Jenny came from Ireland to the U.S. in the 1990s with a few dollars in their pockets and paperwork that allowed them to stay 90 days. They stayed for more than a decade. Paul started a roofing business, and eventually he had 16 people working for him. They bought a home and later a second place in New Hampshire for vacations, paid taxes. But like so many other Irish who came to the U.S. in the 80s and 90s, like so many other people from other countries as well, the lads were illegal immigrants. And last fall, they were deported back to Ireland. As they left, their friends held a wake for them in an Irish bar in the Boston area. And on this St. Patrick's Day, we thought we'd see how they're doing. So Paul Ladd joins us from the village of Kanturk in County Cork in Ireland. Paul, the phrase illegal immigrant, I introduced you that way. Was that how you thought of yourself?
Never really. Never classed myself in that category, but I guess we always knew it in the back of our heads.
What did it mean for you that was your status? What couldn't you do, for instance?
Travel home, back to Ireland, pretty much was the only thing we couldn't do.
Could you get a license and everything?
I first went to America in 1990, and I did my driving test and everything there, so I had an American license for 15 years.
And how did you renew it? I mean, did you just, you know, file the paperwork? There was nothing to check off to say that you were illegal?
Pretty much.
Paid taxes?
No problem at all. Once you have a tax identity number, they will take your taxes every year, no questions asked.
You had a general contractor's license as well. Why couldn't you become an American citizen?
I call myself undereducated or whatever. Unless you were a doctor or highly educated, there was really no pathway for just general labor.
There's quotas and requirements for people who become U.S. citizens, and you didn't qualify?
There's quotas and a lottery, and pretty much I never came out in any one of them.
Ah. Well, here in New England, there was a raid of the Bianco factory in New Bedford. You might remember that.
Yes, I was in Boston that time.
Right. Hundreds of illegal immigrants were separated from their families. It played out on television. These were largely Hispanic immigrants. When you watched that, or you heard anger, you know, in the debate over illegal immigration, you heard anger about illegal Hispanic immigrants. Did you identify with the people who were illegal, or did you identify with the Americans?
I could see both sides, but I've kind of identified with the illegals, I guess, to some degree.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, I felt I could agree with the Americans when you pick up a phone and you got to press 1 for English, 2 for Spanish or whatever. I can see both sides of the argument. I think when you're in an English-speaking country, you should speak English.
I hear that. And yet some would say, you know, that's something that happens sometimes where people say, well, they're not talking about me. They're talking about someone else. When in fact, you know, you were illegal as well.
Yeah. Friends of mine send me email. You know how you get emails and now and again one pops up and they're on about Spanish and then I go back at them, but sure, I was that. And they're, well, we're not meaning you. You speak English. You pay taxes.
Yeah.
Some of these Spanish people pay taxes. Some of these Brazilian people pay taxes. But unfortunately, there's stuff they want to see and there's stuff they don't want to see.
You must know people who are still illegal and Irish living here in the U.S.
A lot.
You know, what do they say to you? How do they, you know, are they ever frightful? Or like you just sort of keep it in the back of their mind where they don't think about it?
I know when I got caught, it hit home with a lot of people, and a good share of friends of mine were really thinking about their situation and how they were going to go forward.
How'd you get caught?
My vacation house, I took up one of my work trucks to do some work and a commercial vehicle checkpoint in New Hampshire. When she realized that my license was out and she asked why didn't I renew it, basically it came out that I was illegal.
Well, so now you've become part of sort of a reverse migration from the U.S. back to Ireland. And many are going home by choice because Ireland is doing so well economically. The jobs are there. The dollar is falling. So how does it feel to go back?
I disagree with how good Ireland is doing. I don't see it. For the general working class person in Ireland, life is no better than it was, or maybe just a little better than it was when I left 15, 16 years ago.
Maybe that's because you don't work in the software industry, which as we hear is what's doing well in Ireland.
It's small niches of the population have done better, but the cost of living here, like a house in the rural country that I live in, costs as much here as it does in downtown Boston.
Huh.
And I still got to travel 40 miles to get work.
Are you finding work?
Yeah, but I wouldn't class it as well paid.
How does it feel as well to return to Ireland as an Irishman who lived an American life? Now, there are huge communities of the Irish here that maintain the cultural ties, but are you no longer the Irishman you were?
Pretty much. I'm pretty much a Yank to most people that stayed here. I am probably going to be an outsider now for a long time.
So how do you feel about the United States now?
I would still be back there in the morning if I got half a chance.
And how do you feel about the issue of illegal immigration? You were very much hoping that the legislation that was worked on last year that would have provided a path to citizenship, you hoped it would pass. It didn't. What do you think the U.S. should do?
They need reform. Something has to be done. You can't deport 12, 15 million people. There's a reason why they're there. There's obviously work, and basically the money attracts them.
Do you think you took work away from an American?
I gave work to Americans. There was always more work than most people could get around to. I honestly don't think I did.
Well, finally, Paul, it is St. Patrick's Day. Are you celebrating? Are you sorrowful?
Sorrowful. There's some very dark days here because I would have never, ever came home. I was one of the few people that it never bothered me that I was 3,000 miles away from my family. I loved the life we had. That's where I'd rather be on St. Patrick's Day.
Well, we hear they'll be lifting a toast to you in a couple of pubs here in Boston. But do you find yourself thinking, too, about other illegals who are sent back to countries where they also don't feel they identify? Latin American countries, countries where they feel a little endangered. Do you find yourself, you know, even more conscious now of that status?
Very much so, yes. I guess I have a better understanding of all that, definitely. Not only America needs immigration reform. Right now I was just in a kitchen where a Canadian girl was coming into Ireland and pretty much she was told she can only come in 90 days per year. The whole world is changing. People are moving an awful lot more.
And the laws, it sounds like you're saying, need to keep up with that.
Ireland has immigration issues. So has France. So has England. So has America. Some of these laws were written 40, 50 years ago when planes and flights weren't as cheap.
Paul Ladd speaking to us from the village of Cantorcan, County Cork, Ireland. I wish you a happy St. Patrick's Day anyway, even though we hear it's kind of somber for you. And thanks for speaking with us.
Not a problem.
Okay, and a heads up now on some of the stories we're working on for later in the week. We're going to speak to a woman who was kicked out of Afghanistan's parliament for insulting male lawmakers. Also, we'll hear the latest on that contagious cancer that's decimating Tasmanian devils. What does it say for cancer in humans? That's all later this week. You're listening to Here and Now. Now it's time to sharpen your pencils for the office pool. The NCAA college basketball tournament schedule is set. March Madness underway. We're going to give you the men's lineup in just a few minutes. The women's lineup will be announced tonight. And heading the roster should be the top-seeded UConn Huskies, whose freshman forward, Maya Moore, is turning heads. The 18-year-old six-footer was ranked the number one women's basketball player in the whole country, as well as the Big East Player of the Year. This is the first time a freshman, male or female, has earned both titles. The Boston Globe's Jackie McMullen has been following Moore's on-court exploits, and Jackie joins us from Tampa, Florida, where she's covering the Red Sox-Yankees exhibition game. You know, critics across the country, Jackie, say we just can't do sports without mentioning the Red Sox here in Boston. But
I know, and here we are again. Boy, I'll tell you, it's packed house here, too, sold out. People are scalping tickets for a spring training game.
Well,
good Lord, it never ends, Robin.
Well, that's what we hear, that, you know, people going down to Florida thinking they'll just, you know, drop by the Red Sox, can't do it.
Oh, but forget about it.
Meantime, all eyes are going to be on basketball. And tell us more about Maya Moore. What is it that's so special about her?
Well, you know, I wanted to see for myself, so I drove down to Storrs a few weeks ago, and I watched her play, and from what I understand, I saw one of her worst games of the year. Now, that being the case, I was pretty excited to then see her play her best game, because even on her worst day, you know, Robin, I haven't seen a player in a long time, male or female, that has a court presence like she has. She sees everything before it's about to happen. She can shoot three-pointers. She can drive in traffic. She's a great rebounder. She's an excellent passer. She can dunk the ball, although she hasn't done that yet in a UConn game. And she just has a sense of the game. She keeps her poise like no one I've ever seen. I can't believe she's a freshman. She really doesn't play like one. And maybe most important of all, she's been able to handle everything Gino Auriemma's thrown her way, and that is really saying something.
This is the famously vitriolic UConn coach. He says that he does try to intimidate the players, and he just can't. It doesn't work with her.
Yeah, no, well, because you know why? They're both perfectionists. They're both they don't like to make mistakes. They can't stand mistakes. And she doesn't make that many, and when she does, he seizes upon it, but she doesn't care because she's already realized that she's made the mistake. She's already working to fix it by the time he points it out, so it's driving him crazy, in a very good way.
Well, now, she was raised largely by a single mom. We understand she's had this poise since she was a child.
Well, yeah, I thought one of the funniest stories your mom told me, when she was just 9 years old, they had her do a public service announcement to fasten your seatbelts, which had nothing to do with the fact that she was a budding young basketball player. They just picked her because she was the most poised of all the little kids they could find. She's really got a knack for it.
Well, UConn beat Rutgers recently, and Coach C. Vivian Stringer says that she thinks that Moore may be the best player in a decade. We're going to talk, by the way, to Coach Stringer in a few minutes about her dust-up with Don Imus and as she goes ahead with her new memoir. But, you know, the buzz about the league, about her, four more years. I mean, how good can she get?
Well, it's amazing that people are – it's one thing to say she's the best freshman in the Big East or the best freshman in the country. It's another thing for people to actually suggest she might be the best player in the game, especially when you have an incredibly talented young woman by the name of Candace Parker who plays for Tennessee, who's one of the best I've ever seen. And to be compared to her already is really something. And, you know, the big question being, will she stay all 4 years? Parker is a junior right now at Tennessee, and she's actually going to be leaving after this year to go to the WNBA. But what I like about Maya is all of this has been happening to her since she's been very young. She's been the top-rated player in her age group since she was a child. And it just doesn't faze her at all because she really isn't concerned about what everybody else thinks. She's only concerned about how she views what she thinks she needs to do to get better. So it's scary to think how long her career is going to go on.
Well, of course, there is the unknown of injuries. Moore was injured in that Rutgers game. She hurt her lower back. But do you think she'll be okay in the couple seconds we have? Will she be okay for the tournament?
I think so, but she has been struggling a little bit since she got back from that. She got banged up pretty good. It was an accident. It was a hard foul. There was no intent there. But she'll be fine. This kid knows how to rise to the occasion. I think she's going to have a big tournament.
Jackie McMullen, who covers sports for the Boston Globe, speaking to us from a very busy Red Sox-Yankees game down there, we can hear.
That's right.
Jackie, thanks so much.
All righty. All the best, Robin.
And in a minute, yeah, we'll get you the guys' lineup, but we're staying with women for now. Coach Stringer will be here in just a few seconds, here and now. Staying with women's basketball, a team almost certain to be part of the women's March Madness lineup will be Rutgers Lady Knights, led by coach C. Vivian Stringer. You may have already been familiar with C. Vivian Stringer's story when the media spotlight landed on her last year. Her team made it to the finals, then lost to Tennessee, but all of that was overshadowed by Don Imus's crude remarks about their hair. Well, Coach Stringer's new book reminds us that when someone lands in the headlines as she did, it's only a glimpse of who they really are. They knew Coach Stringer well in tiny Edenborn, Pennsylvania, where she grew up the daughter of a coal miner and fought to become the first black cheerleader in her school. They still talk about her at Tiny Cheney College near Philadelphia, where her coaching record has been likened to a Hoosiers for girls. And in Iowa, they watched Coach Stringer on TV last year and said, "Isn't that Nina's mom?" Nina being Vivian Stringer's severely disabled daughter. Before Stringer moved to Rutgers, Nina sat front row at virtually every Hawkeye game. Well, C. Vivian Stringer tells her life story in a new book, Standing Tall, A Memoir of Tragedy and Triumph. It's 285 pages long, and Don Imus doesn't even make an appearance till the last 20 pages. Coach Stringer, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you so very much for that wonderful piece.
Well, you know, it's striking reading this book. I'm thinking, geez, Don Imus is like a footnote, but a painful one. So we want to start there. And you write that, you know, the Imus chapter in your life hurt so much because of what had come before, that your whole career had been about the message that you sent your girls, you know, how they presented themselves, the stereotypes of young blacks you knew they'd come up against.
Yeah, and you know what, with all of the teams that I've ever coached, it's all about respecting yourself and standing up and standing tall and being able to know what you think and say what you think, you know, from the bottom of your heart. And so when the team had worked as hard as they had, this the least likely of any team that I'd ever coached, arose through the ranks and ultimately found themselves on stage playing for a national championship, you know, it brings tears to one's eyes. That was the real story. That was a great Cinderella story. But throughout this time, throughout the course of the year, I would continue to give examples, life lessons to my players to help them to understand that, you know, you can overcome anything. And I gave them the example where my father, who had lost both of his legs by the time he was 45 years old, and it died by the time he was 47. But my mom didn't sit down and cry and say, "Woe is me." She found a way to get two jobs and take care of the rest of us, the six brothers and sisters.
So no whining on the part of the girls. No, you know, little things like no untied shoelaces. They always had to look great. And you write you were all too conscious of the stereotype of the black athlete who falls back on his talent, looks for the quick basket. So they always had to play with discipline. You knew how people might look at them.
Exactly. I always understood that. I understood that when I was at Cheney University. And I can guarantee you that any time our team traveled, they looked sharp. They looked like they were actually, you know, applying for an executive position. They always did, and that's why it really stung that he would make these kind of comments. We actually had a beautician with us. And so the key is this, not only black women and men, but also athletes. The general stereotype is you just got, you know, sweatsuits on and you kind of carry yourself anyway. You've got earphones, in your ear, and you're just haphazardly going through things. I've never accepted that.
Yeah. In the middle of the whole Imus thing, you got a text message from former basketball great Moses Malone. Could you, you know, tell us the five words he wrote?
Yeah, he said, "Viv, they hurt our girls." Oh, my God. I cried.
Yeah.
I cried because, you know, I had never received a text from him. He and I only saw each other once a year. But obviously, Moses had read this in the New York Times, so I knew it had legs. And so while I wasn't one that was looking for controversy and was only too happy to we had just played for a national championship. And so what that we heard after the game, we would come to appreciate that we had done something special. This was all blown away in 34 seconds. with the comment that he had made, and so we found ourselves thrust in the spotlight, not asking for Don Imus' job, because it was never what it was. It was to explain who we are. You know, we're all going to have our life's burdens, but we've got to be able to get up and rise. And so the examples that I share in my book, the examples of exactly what happened to these young ladies, how they recover, and who they are, it's important that we learn from each of these experiences, and that's what is key.
Actually, the fifth word in the text message was, they hurt our girls, coach, you know, deferring to you as the coach, with the subtitle of the book, A Memoir of Tragedy and Triumph, plenty of the former. Your daughter Nina, as we said, severely disabled, born healthy, but she contracted meningitis. Your father, as we heard, died young. Your husband, your anchor, died of a heart attack at 47. You were diagnosed with breast cancer during your first year coaching at Rutgers. Through all of it, you know, basketball was both a redemption, but then there was a time, when, and I think after your husband died suddenly, where you almost, you know, even basketball couldn't do it for you.
I couldn't bear it. I couldn't think of living, and yet all I had to do was to look at my mom and think, you know what, my mom made it, and she never cried and she never complained, you know, and I drew strength from her, and that's why my book, I hope, will inspire that people will draw strength from that book and to know that we're all in this world to help one another.
What do you tell the girls? I mean, give us an example. I mean, you know, we read some of the pep talks you give them, everything, you know, from, look at that bumblebee, a bumblebee too fat to fly, but they fly, you know.
Yeah, you read the book.
What do you tell them?
You know, through all of it, it is that they're the most fortunate people in the world, that all you have to do is look at others, people who don't have, you know, the ability to walk or run, but you know, as long as you have a brain, as long as you have hope in your heart, you have dreams, you're willing to pay the price, because at the end of the day, we all have to know what the price is. We can all wish to be all Americans, but the truth of the matter is that we must know the price and we must be willing to pay the price. It's perseverance, it's getting down, you know, being knocked down but not being knocked out, but getting up, and it doesn't really matter where you come from. I tell them, this little girl that came from Edenborn, Pennsylvania, in a coal mining town where seldom did people travel outside of a 50-mile radius, guess what? I've been all over the world, and you can too.
By the way, your team was eliminated from your conference tournament this year, but you're still expected to be in the NCAAs. What will you tell your girls to get them motivated?
You know what? We're even more inspired, more driven. Believe me, I've been so much more focused. These young ladies have been more focused. You know, that has happened. We're going to probably be that much better and that much stronger. We'll overcome. We had three major injuries with the anterior cruciate. Guess what? That we got hurt, we're going to find another way to get it done. We want to be there. So how about if you and all the fans there in Boston just give us a big cheer, and should we arrive on that national stage, just know that we've overcome so much.
And real quick, last question. Don Imus, back on the radio. What, if anything, would you say today? You had real heart-to-heart talk with him. He obviously was so impressed by you and your team. But, you know, what would you say to him today?
Robin, I just want to say that, you know what, I hope that he's a better person. I hope he uses his voice to inspire other people and to let people know that, you know what, at the end of the day, there is hope for change, and that he is a changed person, truly a changed person, because these young ladies will go on. They'll be okay, and we will be okay.
Rutgers basketball coach C. Vivian Stringer, thank you so much.
Thank you so very much. Thank you.